But right now we want to delve into the book of Daniel. And, you know, a lot of studies in the book of Daniel focus in on the prophetic portions of the book. And I got to admit, that's a fascinating study, but we're not going to do that over the next 5 weeks. What we're going to do is study the historical sections of Daniel, and we're going to do it for the purpose of seeing how Daniel interacted in the city of Babylon as a very influential person in that very secular culture. If you look at the city of Babylon, Daniel was in a culture that was thoroughly devoted to the worship of false gods. The culture was in the dragon clutch of the occult. It was a culture where there was immense kinds of brutality. And yet Daniel shines out as a brilliant star in the midst of a black night. It's amazing what Daniel was able to do in the midst of that culture. And part of the reason why I wanted to do this series is that recently I have had people come to me saying, you know, I want to make an impact in my world. How do I do that? How do I let people know that I'm a Christian without appearing foolish in my company, you know, or in my school? How do I express my faith in Christ in such a way that people will be interested in hearing more, not classify me as some, you know, some idiot? How do I do that? And Daniel, probably better than any book in the Bible, I think, models for us how to do that, apart, of course, from Jesus Christ. Now, I've also had people come to me saying, you know, I'm at the point in my career where I don't have that many years left. And I know what it's like to have years of my life where I have engaged in the futility of trying to be a success. And I look back on much of that time and thought, you know, I wasn't invested in the right things. How can I take the time that I have left and become a person of influence? I also know that there are people here who are, you know, students, college, high school, and you've got your whole life in front of you. And the thing that you want to know is there a vision, a compelling vision for my life that will give me energy and direction in the midst of my education? Daniel gives us an incredible illustration of that, because when Daniel gets into Babylon, he's probably only 16 years old. And yet, as a teenager, he makes a radical impact in a non-Christian society, non-Christian culture. Now, I want to say, first of all, that there are three different kinds of influencers. And as I go through these, I want you to think about the kind that you are. We'll look at these as we go through this passage. The first kind of influencer is an influencer who has very visible influence. And you can probably think about these people in your mind. People like Charles Colson, Billy Graham, Chuck Swindoll, James Dobson, they're very visible influencers. There's a second category of influencer who is somewhat visible. These are people who are visible in a city like Bartlesville or in a state like Oklahoma. Or they're people who are visible amidst a certain group of Christians. Some of you may fall into that category. Then there are people who are invisible influencers. And I think most of the people down through the history of the Christian church fall into the category of being invisible influencers. They're people who influence their next-door neighbors. You never hear about them in the newspaper, on TV. They don't write books. But they influence their children. Or they influence their secretaries. Or they influence their bosses. Or they influence the people that they run into, you know, at the Quick Trip, the cashier, or the busboy in the restaurant. They have very significant influence, but it's invisible. Nobody else hears about it except the people that they love for the sake of Christ. My mom this past week told me about an invisible influencer who I deeply respect, but I don't know and probably never will know. My grandfather, at 95 years old, this past Halloween, had a stroke. And he was put into a nursing home or a hospital in Lynchburg, Virginia. As he was recovering from the stroke, there was another woman there, a physical therapist, who helped him learn how to walk again and learned how to, you know, become coordinated again, and did it apparently pretty successfully. She's a believer. And my grandfather has since moved down to Naples, Florida, and on Christmas Eve, this woman wrote my grandfather a letter. And in that letter, she said she very simply expressed her faith in Christ and expressed to my grandfather a desire that he would be restored back to full health. Christmas Eve, she did that. She has four kids, I think. I think she got four kids. She's married. And in the midst of a very busy, hectic schedule, she felt a nudge from God to write a letter to a man who's pretty far away from Christ, who's 95 years old, to express the love of Christ to that man, my grandfather. I deeply appreciate that. She's an invisible influencer, but making a huge impact in the life of a man who doesn't know Jesus Christ. Many of you fall into that category. The writer of the book of Hebrews, in the 11th chapter, lists a whole bunch of influencers. Some are very visible, like Moses. Some are somewhat visible, like Barak. Many of them are invisible. The writer doesn't even know their names. And yet, when he gets to those invisible influencers, he calls them people of whom the world is not worthy. You know why? Because they made major sacrifices that nobody will ever know about for the sake of advancing the kingdom. And let me give you the vision that comes out of the book of Daniel. The vision is, no matter what kind of influencer you are, a Billy Graham kind of influencer or an invisible influencer, God's vision for your life is that you would make an impact, and that that impact would last for all of eternity. Now, this morning we want to start in the book of Daniel. And in this book, I want to give you the overarching principle, foundational principle this morning, that comes out of Daniel's life. And the principle is this: if you want to have impact in non-Christian society, you've got to have cultural flexibility with no moral compromise. You've got to have common ground with no moral compromise. It's the overarching principle that comes out of chapter 1. It's the same principle that Jesus said in John chapter 17. He said that we are to be in the world, but not of it. Being in the world, we're fully engaged with the world, but we don't derive our identity from the world system. Paul put it a different way. Paul said, "I become all things to all men, that by all means I might save some." All things to all men, that by all means I might save some. If we want to be influential in this world, we've got to have cultural flexibility with the world, but without moral compromise. Now let's look at how this happened in Daniel's life. First principle coming out of this book is that Daniel learned his place in the world. When he got to Babylon, he quickly understood that he was a resident alien in a foreign land, just like we are. Look at verses 1 through 3. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, into the house of his god, which, by the way, the name of his god was Marduk. We'll learn about that in a second. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his god, and then he ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles. In the 600s B.C., a massive world power is beginning to develop between the Tigris and the Euphrates River in the area which today is now known as Iraq and ruled by Saddam Hussein. This world power was Babylon, and under the influence of Nabopolassar, it had become unbelievably strong, and everybody around there knew about it. Well, Nabopolassar had a son whose name was Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar was to the armies of those days what Brett Favre was to the Green Bay Packers and to the NFL. A stunning quarterback, great leadership, an amazing football player. He just was incredible. And every battle that Nebuchadnezzar fought as a young man, a teenager really, I mean he's a young guy, every battle Nebuchadnezzar fought, he totally obliterated the enemy. He was a brilliant physical, strategic military leader. Well, if you want a mental picture of this guy, you think about somebody who is strong, who is powerful, a martial artist type guy with a sword and a spear. That's what Nebuchadnezzar was like. Well, in September of 605 BC, the armies of Babylon go from their area, roughly following the route of the Euphrates River, to the area around Jerusalem. They besiege Jerusalem, and Jerusalem, being weak as it was, quickly falls. Meanwhile, in the city of Jerusalem, a young teenager is growing up. His name is Daniel. In the quiet confines of that city, there had been a revival. A guy by the name of Josiah assumed the throne of Israel at the age of 8 years old. Think of it. Guy's like a, you know, second grader. He's the king of Israel in second grade. It's amazing. By the time Josiah is 16 years old, he has personally entrusted himself to the living God. By the time Josiah is 20, he's a young guy who's got a passion. And his passion is to extend the knowledge of God throughout the empire, well, throughout, you know, throughout the kingdom of Judah. And there's a revival that takes place. A distant relative of King Josiah, mom and a dad, have a son by the name of Daniel. And this mom and dad are passionately committed to Jesus, well, you know, to God. And they're passionately committed to the kingdom. And what they want to do is bring up their son in the right way. So they name him Daniel, which means God is my judge. Daniel grew up in a home where the scriptures were taught. Grew up in a home where he could be faithful to God. When Jerusalem fell, an unlikely relationship is forged between an older teenager, Nebuchadnezzar, and a younger teenager named Daniel, and that relationship would become very strong for the next 45 years. So strong that ultimately Daniel would lead Nebuchadnezzar into a relationship with God. Unlikely relationship that God saw would come together. Now, when Jerusalem fell, Nebuchadnezzar had a very clear strategy. Now, think about this. Older teenager has this brilliant military strategy. Look what he says in verse 3. The king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family. See, here's his approach. His approach is to take over the court of Israel and make some of these Jewish boys leaders in Babylon, because he knows if he's got Jewish people in Babylon, he can control the Jewish affairs abroad. Brilliant strategy. So Ashpenaz makes a beeline to the royal court, gathers all the young teenage boys. And these guys had to be young enough so that they could be enculturated into Babylon. Because when you're young, you know, you can be enculturated in a cross-cultural experience. They also had to be smart enough to pick up the learning that they were going to have, and they had to be good-looking enough to overcome the racial barriers. When Ashpenaz saw Daniel, he knew he had his man. And Daniel passed the test with flying colors, along with three other friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And these four teenagers, with very little warning, are going to be ripped away from Jerusalem, ripped away from their parents, torn away from their friends, from their religion, from their culture, to make a 600-mile-long trip back to a land that was strange and foreboding. Now think about this. Imagine you're told in a moment's time that you're going to leave Bartlesville, you're going to leave Oklahoma, leave the United States of America, you're going to go to a foreign land, you'll never see your parents again, never be able to see your friends again, and you've got to prepare for this in a moment's time. It was devastating for these guys. Extremely difficult. Not only did Nebuchadnezzar seize control of the king's court, but he tried to seize control of the religion of Israel. So what he does is he goes into the house, the temple that Solomon had built. He takes all the utensils of worship, takes them to his place in Babylon, to the temple of Marduk, thinking that if he could disable the Jewish religion, he could disable the God of Judaism. Big mistake. Big mistake. So he takes those things into the temple of Marduk in Babylon. Daniel, Mishael, and Azariah, I think with tears in their eyes, leave the familiar surroundings of Jerusalem. And when that city goes over the horizon, they are dark in their insides. They're in pain. And months later, they see the city of Babylon come up on the horizon. When they see that city, they're amazed with what God is doing. They're discouraged. They're anticipating. They wonder what's going to happen. It's a time of confusion, bewilderment, very great difficulty. Now, why did God allow this to happen? Why is it that God would take His chosen nation, allow it to be besieged by an enemy, and destroy it? Well, the reason why is in verse 2. It says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. God did it. Why did God do it? It's because Israel had an addiction to idolatry that lasted the entire history up to that point. Like a drug addict who goes back to his drug of choice, or a sex addict who goes back to having an affair, Israel constantly plunged into idolatry. And finally God said, enough is enough. And he used the galloping armies of Babylon to judge Israel for their constant idolatry. Now, that's why Daniel was thrust into Babylon. But you know what? You and I are not thrust into a secular culture suddenly. You and I are born into it. When you and I are born into the culture in the United States of America, we are born into a non-Christian culture. One of the things Daniel realized instantly was that he was a resident alien in a foreign land. The perspective that you and I have after we become believers is that our citizenship is in heaven. It's not here on this earth. Our citizenship is in heaven, and we have a vision that Jesus Christ will come either for us on this earth, or we will go to him at the time that we die. But our true home is not here. It's in heaven. The writer of Peter says it just the reverse. He says that we are aliens and strangers on the face of this earth. When I was living in France in 1977 for 6 months, I knew I was a resident alien in a foreign land. And I can remember that I went to the Campus Crusade director at SMU and I said, I want to buy the French version of the four spiritual laws, you know, because I want to give these out when I go to France. And I can remember my roommate and I looking for opportunities to pass out these tracts. And there was a woman who was deposited by her family every day on the steps of the opera building in Paris. And one day my roommate and I bought a couple of oranges and we gave them to this woman who we couldn't understand her, she couldn't understand us. We took the tract and we read the tract to her in French as best we could, which was not very good. But I can remember, you know, her eyes lit up when she saw the food, and they lit up when we went through and taught and shared the gospel with her. But, you know, part of our idea was, you know, we're resident aliens. You know, let's do some damage in this city for Christ. Let's do something unique and exciting. When you feel like a resident alien, you feel motivated to do something because you know that you're only there for a short period of time. That's the perspective I think Daniel had when he got into the city of Babylon. See, when you and I are born into this world, we're born into a thing the Bible calls the world system. And if we're not careful, we can buy into the world system, which says this: how can I bypass God to meet my needs? What can I do to meet my needs apart from God? So what some of us do is we say, I know how I'm going to meet my needs apart from God. I'm going to get friends. And I'm going to make as many friends as I can. I'm going to make the best friends that I can. And in making those friends, I'm going to bypass God to get my needs, my relational needs met. Some of you know what that's like at school, because sometimes you want so much to have good friends that you say, I'm going to do what my friends' values are, even if they conflict with what God's values are. Ever done that? Very easy to do. Some others of you have said, I'm going to bypass God by career success. I'm going to become so successful in my career that I just don't need to trust in God quite that much. Others of you have said, I'm going to amass a lot of things, and those things will satisfy me so that I don't have to be passionately devoted to trust God. That's the world. And if we're not careful, we can be swept up into that whole way of thinking. There's another alternative. The other alternative is to embrace your identity as a citizen of heaven, as a resident alien on the earth, and say, my goal in life is to make an impact for Jesus Christ. Maybe with visible influence and maybe with invisible influence, but that's my passion in life. Jesus is the one who models that. You know, Jesus called us to be salt and light. Jesus said, let your light so shine before men that people will see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. How do you do that? Let's go back to Daniel. And that brings us to the second question that we want to ask, and that is, how did Daniel gain influence in the secular arena? Look at verse 4. Ashpenaz brought in youths. Whenever I say that word, I think of Ute you know, from My Cousin Vinny, the movie, youths. Youths in whom there were no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding, discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered them to teach them the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration of the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. And to Daniel he assigned the name of Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. It took me a long time to learn how to pronounce those names. I want you to know. Now, the first thing that they do is they seek common ground with the world. If you and I are going to make an impact, we've got to seek common ground with the world, and that's the first thing that they're presented with. Once Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah arrive in Babylon, they enter a very intensive 3-year training course in Babylonian culture, which is designed to enculturate them into Babylonian way of thought and to strip them of their Jewish way of thinking. In that graduate program, they were going to meet 4 ethical sorts of conditions that would test their faith. And they've got to determine where they can be flexible and where they've got to stand their ground. The first area that they would study is the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The Babylonians had 2 languages. They had Aramaic, which was very easy for them to understand. Be like you and I picking up Spanish, you know. For some of us that's easy, others hard. But the other language was Akkadian, and that had totally different kinds of an alphabet. You take a wedge-shaped stylus and impress it into wet clay, and it is one difficult language to try to understand. Once they got the language down, they were going to read all of the great works of the in Aramaic and in Akkadian. And once they got the language down, you know, they're going to learn math, they're going to learn architecture, physics, astronomy, law. All of those subjects were designed to give them a graduate-level liberal arts education in the area of Babylonian culture. But everything they learned was predicated on the worldview of the Babylonians. You know what a worldview is? It's a way of looking at all of life. We embrace a Judeo-Christian worldview that says there's an infinite personal God controlling the universe. They embraced a polytheistic worldview, which said there are many, many little gods out there, and those gods are vying for power and control, and you've got to satisfy those gods, and if you satisfy those gods, they'll give you power. That's the worldview that was embraced there. And everything they're learning was through the worldview of their polytheistic theology. You know, some of you high school students are going to go off to college in a few years, and you'll have professors who are atheists. At the University of Maryland, when we were living in Baltimore, there was a professor there who, in the freshman literature class, said, "How many of you are Christians?" And these freshmen, you know, some of the freshmen would raise their hand. He said, "My goal is that by the end of this semester, you will discard your antiquated faith in Jesus Christ and embrace the truth of atheism." And everybody knew about this professor. Campus ministries all knew about this professor. But that was his stated goal. I talked to a guy who got his PhD at Harvard in literature. I was doing a wedding, and this was one of the groomsmen in the wedding. And he claimed to be a Christian. And I said, "How do you live out your Christianity at St. Mary's College in New York City?" He said, I don't live it out. He says, "In case you don't know, the humanities in America is controlled by atheists." And he says, "If I were to disclose my Christianity, I wouldn't get tenure, I wouldn't get pay increases, I'd be the laughingstock of the English department in my university. There's no way I could do that." Some of you students are going to take courses from those folks. You'll face the same challenge that Daniel faced in Babylon when he was learning the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. The second area of enculturation was the food. Jewish dietary laws? Are you kidding? And Babylon, forget it. There was no Jewish dietary laws. This program of eating the king's food was part of the whole package of learning to be a state official. How many of you have been to a great restaurant like the French Room in Dallas, or the Mansion on Turtle Creek, or Star Canyon, my favorite restaurant, New Texas Cuisine? When you go to a restaurant like that, part of what you feel is the prestige of having waiters hover over you. Mr. McElvain, any more? You know, can I give you anything else? You know, you feel better, don't you? Feel great. Well, these guys are going to be state officials. They needed to know how to act at the dinner table in the state court of Babylon. When I was in college, one of my roommates went out to a very fancy restaurant at the top of one of the office towers in Dallas. And when he was there, he very sophisticatedly ordered steak tartare. And when the waiter brought it, he'd never ordered steak tartare before. When the waiter brought it, he looked at it and he said, you know, steak tartare is basically raw ground beef with very little fat in it. He looked at it and he said, could you take this back and cook a little bit more? And everybody around the table just burst out laughing. It was a big social faux pas. The king could not afford a social faux pas for these guys who were entrusted with responsibility. They had to know about the food. Another area of enculturation was the area of the new names. The names were very important to them. They're important to us. You know, I'm named after my dad. Many of you are named after family members. But in Israel, your name was even more important than it is to us in America, because your name usually included a reference to God. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all four of those guys had names that made reference to the God of Israel. They valued their names, and whenever those names were stated, it was a lifelong reminder that you belong to the true God. But now they're going to have to exchange their names for names of the Babylonian gods. So, Daniel becomes Belteshazzar. And now you got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now just think about this. Imagine you're working for a firm that or a company that's owned by a man of the Islamic faith. And he says, now that you've joined the company, now that you're on our insurance program, just one more thing. You're going to have to change your name. Your name will now become Alibaba. Your name will now become Abdul. Your name will now become Muhammad. Like it or leave it. I'm sorry. That's what it was like for those guys. They had to exchange their names for totally different names. The fourth area of enculturation was that they had new occupations in the court of the king. After a three-year graduate training program, before their 20th birthday, they are now going to become officials in the state of Babylon. Very important people, but they're going to be working for a man who's brutal, a man who's unethical according to their viewpoint, a man who's immoral according to their viewpoint, a man who thought nothing of capricious capital punishment and torture. They're going to be believers in a radically secular culture. Now, those are the four areas of enculturation. They come in rapid-fire succession. They're not asked their opinion about it. They're just given those things. And these guys had to determine, where am I going to be flexible and where am I going to be firm? Realize that you and I are in the same boat, aren't you? We live in a society where you and I have constantly got to ask ourselves, where can I be culturally flexible? And where do I need to stick up and be firm? That's the situation these guys were in. The model for us is Jesus Christ. When Jesus interacted in the world, what was he nicknamed? A friend of tax collectors and sinners. Jesus did not avoid the appearance of evil when he was ministering on this earth. He made a beeline to those people who needed God. He went with the prostitutes. No moral compromise there. He went with the tax collectors. There was no moral compromise. He went with the people who were the friends of the tax collectors and sinners. There was never more any moral compromise. He hung out with the people who knew God. He was culturally flexible, but there was never any moral compromise. We got to do what Daniel did and his friends did. We got to sift everything in the culture and ask ourselves, where is it clear and where is it unclear? Where do I need to embrace commitment to God, and where do I have a little cultural flexibility here? Now, Whenever you face common ground, you face the possibility for compromise. So what did Daniel do? Daniel stayed committed to the word. Look at what happens. Daniel stayed committed to the word. Verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. Now let's stop there for a second. Daniel was presented with these four areas of enculturation, and I don't know this for sure, but I think he reasoned this way. It's okay for me to learn the language and the literature of the Babylonians. Yes, they have a different worldview. No, I don't agree with everything they say, but there's nothing wrong with it per se. Okay? Nothing wrong with a good secular education per se. Besides, wasn't Moses educated in all of the language and the literature of Egypt? Yes, he was. Acts chapter 7, Stephen, before his stoning, makes it very clear that Moses was educated in all of the education of the people of Egypt. So Daniel says, I've got a biblical precedent for getting a good secular education, and I'm going to embrace it. And I got, again, let me just address that to dissuade you from Christianity. And I had friends in college who were Christians who allowed their professors to dissuade them from Christianity. When I was doing ministry with college students at Loyola University in Baltimore, I spoke to a group that said there's a humanities professor that has just wreaked havoc to Christians all over the university. You can allow them to dissuade you from Christianity. It'd be a tragic mistake, but that happens. The other thing you could do is kind of fit into their stereotype of an irate fundamentalist student and just challenge everything that they say all of the time and make them feel as if you are constantly butting heads with them. I did that in high school with a teacher, and I made no progress at all. The third thing you can do is do what Daniel did. Submit to the education and get as much of it as you can. Learn everything you can about evolution, because in learning about it, you will have a lot to say against it. Learn what they say about why Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Because the more you know about what they say about why Jesus didn't rise from the dead, the more you can tell them about why Jesus did rise from the dead. I got my greatest arguments in college from people who would argue against the resurrection of Christ. You know, it all falls apart once you understand their arguments for why Christ didn't rise from the dead. Get a good secular education. But while you're getting that, learn the Christian viewpoint on what you're learning. That's what I think Daniel did. All right, what about the new names? That's the second area. You know, that would have been pretty painful to have their names changed. I think Daniel went back in his mind, though, to the Scriptures. He went back to Genesis 41:41. And in Genesis 41:41, he discovered that Joseph adopted the name Zaphnath-Paneah, which was the name of the god of Pharaoh. So he looks at that and he says, well, wait a second. Not only is there a precedent for learning and getting a good secular education, there is a biblical precedent for adopting a new name. And I'm going to do it as long as there's a biblical precedent for it. Then I think he looked at the secular vocation and asked, is it okay for me to have a secular vocation in a secular society? He would have gone back again to Genesis 41:41, where Joseph was the prime minister in Egypt. So he says to himself, okay, I got a biblical precedent for the name change, for the secular vocation, for the language and the literature, good secular education. I'm going to go ahead and embrace those things, but there was one area where he was not free, and that was in the area of the food. I think what Daniel probably did was he thought, this food runs contrary to my understanding of Exodus 34 and verse 15. If you look at Exodus 34:15, what that verse says to Israel is, do not eat meat sacrificed to idols, because in doing that, you might get swept up into the culture. That's what might happen. So Daniel says, three areas I'm okay with, one area I'm not okay with, therefore I can't eat the meat sacrificed to idols. Now, Daniel could have just said, what the heck? What the heck? I mean, Jerusalem's destroyed. You know, I just got to survive here. So I'm just going to forget what Exodus 34:15 says and just do it. He didn't say that. What he said was, I've got to do what the Scriptures tell me to do, and I'm going to do it. I don't care what the consequences are. So Daniel decided not to do it. Now let me tell you something. If you're going to be in common ground relationships, you've constantly got to sift through what is okay biblically and what's not okay. Daniel discovered that there was one area that wasn't okay, and he was committed to the Word to not do it. You know, in your occupation, in your school, you're going to constantly run across people who ask you to compromise your conscience. May happen because somebody asks you to, as an accountant for instance, to overstate income or to understate income for accounting reasons. They're a client and you need clients. So what do you do? You say, I can't do it. Or somebody asks you to falsify results that you got on a lab report because it disagrees with what a professor is writing in a journal article. What do? You do it or not do it? Violates your conscience, violates ethics. It's clear, you don't do it. Or somebody asks you to perform a medical procedure which violates what you feel like the Bible says, and you say, I can't do it. See, you'll always be asked, if you have common ground with the world, to compromise your convictions as a Christian. An example of Daniel is he says, I will not do anything that compromises what the Bible says about how to live my life. I'm clear about that. And so he doesn't do it. The temptation to compromise will constantly come up. And to combat that, we've got to be able to know what the Bible has to say about certain situations. Sometimes we'll say, I can participate in this common ground. Other times we'll say, I cannot and I won't do it. And I don't care what the results are. I won't do it. I'm going to stand up for it. Let me tell you something. When you stand up for your convictions and refuse to violate your standards, you desperately need a group of people around you who will support you in the process. That's why we have small groups at Grace Community Church. That's why we hope to create a very vibrant youth ministry at Grace Community Church. Because when you say, I'm going to live for Christ, you got to have a group around you who says, yes, we support you. You know, if people reject you, we're going to stick with you closer than a brother. You need that. Now let's look at the next thing that Daniel did. Daniel gained influence not only by common ground, not only by commitment to the Word, but he gained influence by treating people with wisdom and common sense. See, Daniel's on the horns of a dilemma. This could cost him dearly. And so what Daniel does is he seeks permission to do something. Look at verse 8, second half. He sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted favor to Daniel in the sight of the commander of the officials. And he said, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has appointed your food and your drink. Why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are of your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer of the commander of the officials, please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. This is a brilliant way for Daniel to get what he wanted and to stay faithful to God. What he does first is he goes to the ultimate boss, Ashpenaz. And he tells the ultimate boss, here's what we want to do. And Ashpenaz is very sympathetic to them because God has been working through Daniel to influence Ashpenaz. But he says, I'm not going to tell you what to do. So Daniel goes into his immediate superior, who was the overseer. And Daniel says, look, let me propose an alternative to you. We eat vegetables. The other guys in the program have the meat. They're the control group. We're the test group. You look at us and look at them after 10 days. And if we're, you know, looking pretty good, pretty healthy, go ahead and let us have the vegetables, will you? Guy agrees with the process. That's brilliant. It's brilliant. Because what Daniel was doing was he was being sensitive to the political realities in that culture. Now look, in every organization you're in, there are political realities. If you work the politics of the organization for yourself, people will look at you as being selfish and conniving. They're not going to see Jesus Christ at all. But if you look at the political realities and you're sensitive to those realities for spiritual reasons, not selfish reasons, it builds trust. You know, a high school student who, you know, is sensitive to the political structures and the authority structures in the school builds trust with people. And people say, even though he's a believer, I trust him. Same thing happens in the corporation. When you're sensitive to the political realities, people look at you and they say, yes, that person is a believer. Yes, they have strong convictions, but I trust them. There's common sense there. I trust them. If you want to build influence, you've got to be sensitive to the realities of the organization that you are in and be wise. Daniel shows great wisdom by asking permission. Daniel could have been the stereotypical fundamentalist, very judgmental. He could have said, commanded the officials, says in Exodus chapter 34, the 15th verse, don't eat meat sacrificed to idols. I believe what he says. I'm not going to do it. I demand you to do what God tells me to do. That wouldn't have worked. He lost his head. And asking permission, though, he says, there is a black and white here. God says, don't do this. But I'm going to be wise in the way I express that. I'm going to ask permission, trusting that God will work through my relationship, and I'm going to trust that God will give permission to me through that person so that I can obey Him. See the trust that's involved there? When you and I blast into the world, black and white, we don't build trust. A lot of times we build animosity. But when you and I hold black and white firmly in our minds, but treat people with wisdom and grace and discretion and discernment, people trust us. And that's why Ashpenaz was open when Daniel said, give us permission. Give us permission. And the guy and basically says, I'm sensitive to what you want, but I'm going to decline your request. And so Daniel goes to his immediate boss. It's a brilliant strategy. What's the result? Well, the result is, if you and I want to influence, be people of influence, we got to, number one, find common ground. Number two, we got to stay committed to the Word. Number three, we got to use wisdom and common sense in dealing with people. Look at the result in verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. And at the end of the days which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with him, personal interview he had with them. And not one of them was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's personal service. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians, the conjurers, who were in his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. The result was, God worked through their common ground, their commitment to the Word, and their common sense to establish them to be influencers. Now, if you and I want to be people of influencers, let me give you two applications. Number one, you got to assess your goal. You got to assess your goal. What's your goal? Tomorrow morning when you get up, go to school. Tomorrow when you get up and go to your corporation. Tomorrow when you get up and go to your medical practice. Tomorrow when you get up and you take care of kids in your house. What's your goal? Is your goal my own personal advancement, my own personal happiness? Or is your goal a transcendent goal of advancing the kingdom of God in your sphere of influence? You know, you and I all have immediate goals. If you're a student, your immediate goal is to get a good education. If you're an employee, your immediate goal is to do a good job on the job. But what's your ultimate goal? Your ultimate goal, according to Daniel's illustration, is to advance God's kingdom, however that works out in your sphere of influence. It's important to assess your goal, because if it falls short of advancing the kingdom, many of those things become our own personal gods. And it short circuits any influence we could have. And then the second thing is, examine your role. Not all of you will have the kind of influence Daniel had. Daniel becoming the prime minister is equivalent to you becoming the corporate president of a large corporation or division head. You know, you may not have that kind of influence. However, you always will have influence at some level, even if it's moderate influence or even if it's invisible influence. Don't despise the level of influence that you presently have.
The goal is, be faithful to be an influencer in whatever sphere God has put you in. Some of the people who are living the most successful, consistent Christian lives are people who have invisible influence. And their neighbors see them, their kids see them, everybody sees them, and what they say is, I trust them. I'm open to the things they say to me. Be an influencer. Be an influencer. So tomorrow morning, you wake up and you go into your sphere of influence, whatever that is. Here's the key. Number one, find common ground with the world. Number two, stay committed to the Word. Number three, cultivate common sense and wisdom. As you do that, trust that God will use those for you to make an impact. An impact that will last for eternity. God's vision for your life is that you would seek first His kingdom and its righteousness, and then all these things will be added to you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the example of Daniel. What a great example. Father, I pray that we could enter into our sphere of influence with a passion to make a difference for Jesus Christ. We do this, Father, for your sake and for your glory. Amen.